So I'm going to be in the Binding of Isaac today. And one of the things I said last week is these stories in the Torah serve lots of different purposes. They serve as patterns. They serve as, of course, real stories. And this one is very much the same way. I'm going to talk about it from two different perspectives. I'm going to talk about it from a Christian perspective, and then I'm going to talk about it from the perspective of Rabbi Sacks. Rabbi Sacks has got a take on the Binding of Isaac that I had never thought of, and I think he's right, in addition to the Christian perspective. I'm not saying either or, I'm saying both and. So the Christian perspective is, first off, there are three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham is the prototypical father. Isaac is the son of promise. And then Jacob is the one who goes out into the world to get a bride. In that sense, he's representative of the Holy Spirit. So you've got the three patriarchs, if you will, representing the three persons of God. So when Abraham, the prototypical father, takes Isaac, his son, and offers him up, what obviously it is doing is prefiguring Yeshua and his sacrifice. Very straightforward. The other thing about this, and it happens in this vignette as well as at Yeshua's, is the son cooperates. In the case of Yeshua, he knows what's going to happen. He goes willingly and cooperates with his father. Isaac does too. So the parallels are very good. There are two witnesses. At the crucifixion, you have the two thieves, one on either side. When Abraham leaves, he goes with two young men. And of course, the young men don't go up. 3 days. Yeshua is in the grave for 3 days and three nights. It is a three-day journey from where Abraham is called to the place where Isaac is going to be sacrificed. So again, once God says sacrifice him, he is symbolically dead. So he is dead for 3 days and then is raised from the dead on top of the mountain when God stays Abraham's hand. And Mount Moriah, it's the same place, and he is carrying the wood himself. So Christ carries his cross. Isaac is carrying the wood that is going to be used for the burnt offering. And then we have a crown of thorns because the ram who is ultimately sacrificed has got his horns caught in a thorn thicket. So we have a crown of thorns. And then the other thing that happens in the Binding of Isaac is only one of them comes down the mountain. If you read the story, it says Abraham went down the mountain. It doesn't say anything about Isaac. So the next time we see Isaac is when Abraham's servant shows up with Rebekah. So between the time that he is spared by God until his bride comes, you don't see him, at least not in the text. And that is typical of Yeshua going up to heaven and then waiting there until a bride is gotten for it. So this is clearly the entire crucifixion and resurrection story. And it is both and, because there's another perspective on this. Now, Rabbi Sacks is one of my favorite rabbis, and sadly he's dead, but I never can understand why he's not a Christian, because his insights are so wonderful. And I'm sure at this point he is, but before he died, he was. And by the way, he also probably knows more about Christianity in the New Testament than your average Christian does. So it's not that he's ignorant. One of the things that is interesting, when God calls Abraham and says, I want your son, Abraham is silent. He doesn't say a word. Yet in the previous vignette, Sodom and Gomorrah, when God says to Abraham, I'm going to go down and wipe this place out, Abraham argues with him. I mean, he's very polite, typical Middle Eastern thing, but his thing is, wait a minute, that isn't right. He is telling God that for God to wipe out a city, if there should be 50 people in it, is not just. It is not right. So he is perfectly capable of complaining to God when he thinks God is doing something wrong. And in that sense, he is an independent moral agent. He has got his own sense of morality put into him by God, and he exercises it. Moses does the same thing. So the idea here of him saying, oh, you want me to sacrifice my son? Oh, cool. That's the first problem. He doesn't say a word. So why? Well, Sachs says, and I kind of agree with him, he didn't think that it was going to happen, which of course it doesn't. Because the first thing that God told him is that his legacy, if you will, was going to be through Isaac. Okay, you've told me here that my legacy is going to be through Isaac. Now you're telling me to sacrifice. Okay, got it. Something's going on here. But I know your character. You made a promise. You're going to fulfill that promise. So you're going to work this out. I don't know how, but you're going to work it out. Sachs says that the conventional reading of this in rabbinic literature and in Christianity, both. I mean, he's talking from a rabbinic point of view, but it's the same point of view that Christians have. And I'll read it to you from Sachs. The conventional reading of this passage is that Abraham was being asked to show that his love of God was supreme. He would show this by being willing to sacrifice the son for whom he had spent a lifetime waiting. Why did God need to test Abraham, given that he knows the human heart better than we know ourselves? Maimonides answers that God did not need Abraham to prove his love for him. Rather, the test was meant to establish for all time how far the fear and love of God must go. In other words, the whole point of the test is to show everybody that God is first no matter what. That's the conventional reading of that. Sachs doesn't agree, and having read Sachs, I don't think it's right either. So what does Sachs say? Well, the idea of child sacrifice is not really much of a test, because all of the cultures throughout history have done it. And in fact, by the time of Manasseh and Ahaz, Israel is doing it themselves. And God explicitly says, that is not right. I don't want you to be doing that. And I'll read it to you from Jeremiah. I mean, it's all over the place. But Jeremiah 7. For the sons of Judah have done evil in my sight, declares the Lord. They have set their detestable things in the house that is called by my name to defile it. And they have built the high places of Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command, nor did it come to my mind. God is unalterably opposed to human sacrifice. So Sachs's point, and I completely agree, is unalterably opposed to human sacrifice, except for Abraham. Well, how does Abraham then get to be a role model for us if he gets to sacrifice his son, but nobody else does? So the idea here is one of the reasons that there's no God. What do you think you're doing here? That wouldn't be right. He says that in defending Sodom, but he doesn't say that in defending his own son. And the reason for that is he doesn't believe it's going to happen. Every Christian pastor I've ever heard talk about this, talk about the fact that his gut is all wrenched up and roiling as he's going up with his son and just terrible emotional stuff, and I'm not sure that's true. Because one of the things that he says as he leaves the two servants with the donkeys, we're going to go up and worship and then we will come back. It specifically says, we will come back. Now, you could say, well, that's because he doesn't want them to know what's really going to happen. I don't think so. I think he expects to come back with his son. Now, how that's going to work out, he doesn't know at the time, but he trusts God that it will work out that way. So, besides the Christian application, with which I completely agree, what is the point of this exercise? The Christian application by itself would be worth doing, but what is the point of the exercise here? What I said, and Sachs said, and everybody knows, is all sorts of other societies practice human sacrifice and child sacrifice. So maybe what God is doing here is saying that isn't right, first off, but the culture in that time, in that age, was called patriarchy, and the father of a family had absolute control and authority over his wives, his servants, and his children. So the idea that a father had complete ownership of his children was widespread, and it even goes into Roman law, by the way. In Roman law, if a father decides that the new child doesn't want it, he can say, all right, abandon it, get rid of it, sacrifice it. He has capital authority over his wife, so if his wife annoys him, he can have her killed. That was the extent of the authority of fathers in that world at that time. Their children were the property of the fathers until the father died, and then that authority went to the firstborn. Notice, by the way, that nobody except Abraham in the chain of the patriarchs is a firstborn. Ishmael is not the one who inherits. Isaac is. Esau is not the one who inherits. Jacob is. Reuben is not the one who inherits. Levi becomes the priest, and Judah and Joseph become the kingly lines. None of those are firstborn. So one of the things God is saying here is, stop it. I'm not going to do things that way. That's one of the lessons, if you will, here. So Isaac is not a firstborn. That's thing one. Thing two is, your children don't belong to you. You can't do whatever you want with them because they are independent souls and they belong to me. So what Abraham is doing as a prototypical father is he is stepping up to God and saying, I do not own this young man. You do. And what you have here is the birth of individualism, where it becomes clear that in God's eyes, each of us is an individual. Each of us matters as an individual personally, as opposed to being somebody else's property that can be used and disposed of any way that the father wants, which is what every other culture in the world does. Furthermore, every other culture has its own gods, and most of them do ancestor worship. So they sacrifice to their ancestors. God specifically says in the Torah, don't do that. I'm the only God. So this whole paternalistic family structure, if you will, that the pagans and the Romans have evolved, God is explicitly breaking down in this process. I didn't choose the firstborn. Your children belong to me. They don't belong to you. You are a steward. They're yours to raise. They're yours to train. They're yours to love, but they belong to me. And by the way, we see that same thing with Hannah. Hannah, remember, is the mother of Samuel. You remember in the birth of Samuel that Hannah is barren. Her husband has two wives, one of whom is bearing children, Hannah is not. And Hannah goes to the temple when they are getting ready to sacrifice, and she falls down before God and she prays for a child. And the priest looks at her and says, are you drunk? He says, no, I'm not drunk. I'm praying for a child. The next year, when she has Samuel, she says, you have given me a son, God. I am giving him back to you. In other words, your son is a gift from you. I'm giving him back to you. And as soon as Samuel is weaned, she then sends him off to Eli and goes and sees him every year and makes him a new set of clothes and so forth. But she recognizes that the child is not her property, the child is God's. And that's the point that this business with Isaac and the sacrifice is making. Not that everybody in the world can't sacrifice their children, but Abraham can. If you get a word from God, it's okay, but otherwise it's not okay. Because that opens the door to every religious wacko in the world who thinks he has a vision from God and goes off and does weird things. So if that's the message, that if you hear from God, you get to sacrifice your children, then you've misunderstood what's going on here in this vignette. And your key here, if you will, is Abraham doesn't say a word. He simply does what God told him to do because he knows God has made him a promise. And he's made him a specific promise about Isaac. It is not the case that, okay, yeah, go sacrifice Isaac and we'll get you another one. That's not what's going on. Isaac is going to be the one through whom his legacy is, period. So where he gets in God's face for Sodom and Gomorrah, he doesn't say a word here. Goes off and does it. And when he leaves the two witnesses with the donkeys, he says, we're both coming back. When his son says, Dad, we got the fire, we got the wood, we got the knife, where's the lamb? He says, God will take care of it. God will provide a ram. And then when we get up there, for Christian typology, the son cooperates with the father in his own sacrifice. Remember I said this is Christian typology, which is absolutely correct, but it's also something else. I believe, along with Sachs, that the conventional wisdom here that you got to be ready to sacrifice your son to show how much you love God is wrong. Because every pagan society does that. Thousands of children have been sacrificed. Israel himself did it. And God gets really upset with them for doing it. And so if that was the lesson here, then you could say of Ahaz or Manasseh, oh, wait a minute, God, why are you upset with me? Abraham did it. The point is, he's done this once, and the lesson is messianic typology, big time. He wants to show what's going to happen with his own son, and that there's going to be a resurrection and all that kind of stuff. That's very straightforward. But the other lesson, most people, I believe, and Sachs believes, get wrong. It is not that in order to show your devotion, you got to sacrifice your son. This was done one time because we needed the messianic preference, and it's also done to show that the pagan system of the father having absolute ownership of everybody in his family, to include capital ownership, is not right. The Torah is against everything there. The business of the firstborn, the sacrificing of children, all that kind of stuff. The Torah is against all of it. Ancestor worship, all of the things that were prevalent back then. One other thing that just crossed my mind. There's a passage in Torah that says, if you've got a rebellious son who is a drunkard and a wine bibber, and he won't obey anything that you tell him, what does the Torah say to do with him? What the Torah says is you take him to the elders who will adjudicate the case. And then, if this guy is worthless, they will stone him. You don't get to make that decision yourself. And that's the whole point, that parents do not have capital authority over their own children, because the children are individuals who belong to God. You have stewardship. You don't own them.